Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, and a distinctly Phase 2 bunch of files filled with lockdown nostalgia and the plague of freedom. This time, Paddy Woodworth goes into the wild places in the company of Robert McFarlane's writing, and we hear about the delicate business of singing while playing the fiddle from composer, singer, violinist Andrew Hamilton. Later on, Maurice Gohan gives us all the talking to we all need before heading out into the world again. But we begin with Jennifer Walsh, whose message is aimed at one particular family member.
My niece and nephew are still very small. Around their birthdays in June and August, I find myself drafting letters to them. These are not letters to be read now. They're letters intended for their adult selves, where I try to talk about the larger world they live in at the moment. Some notes on what it was like beyond Lego and My Little Pony Friendship is Magic. It's my nephew's birthday today. I write that when the pandemic hit, there was great fear and shock and grief. There was also kindness and sacrifice and courage. There were so many people who helped in so many different ways. The frontline workers who put their lives on the line, the doctors and nurses and ambulance drivers, the people who kept collecting the bins, delivering the post, stacking the shelves, the community groups sewing PPE, organizing meals for heroes, the neighbours posting Grandad's letters, painting Grandma's wall. The children, like him, who stayed away from playgrounds. This narrative shows the best of us. It shows us coming together. But the pandemic is not the great leveller. There are structural inequalities everywhere. People are experiencing the pandemic from a luxury Airbnb with live-in tutor for their children in Killiney. They're also experiencing it from a tiny room in a direct provision centre. And what has been heartbreaking over the last months, and particularly over the last few weeks, is to see human beings continuing to treat each other with utter cruelty, regardless of the pandemic. Domestic violence tripled during the lockdown, and we were helpless to do anything other than to donate to shelters. And very recently, a police officer knelt on George Floyd's neck and kept kneeling until the poor man died. I tell my nephew about the protests, not only in America, but all around the world, in Ireland, here in London, about the anger and the heartbreak, about people who risk violence at the hands of the police, who risk infection in order to demand justice for people they have never met, about the signs in windows, even here on my street, saying that Black Lives Matter. About the beauty of people coming together in kindness, in solidarity, to bring about change. I tell my nephew that Irishness doesn't automatically exclude you from acting in ways which are racist, from being racist. That pale Celtic skin comes with a lot of privileges. But we can make choices. We can educate ourselves. We can be allies. We can choose to be like Bernadette Devlin. I tell him that this is the world you are in right now. We are trying our best, and we need to keep trying, always. I know you and your sister will try your hardest to make it better. Happy birthday, dear one.
Jennifer Walsh there with a letter to her nephew, and the music you heard was Sauve Doe by Queevin Brannock, who in some worlds, not in all, is the great-great-uncle of the recipient. Jennifer Walsh's Aisteach archive, aisteach.org, has more information on that puzzle. And next, singer, composer and violinist Andrew Hamilton does it all at the same time. Just out on Ergodos Records is Hamilton's album Joy, on which the Dubliner develops his childhood habit of singing to the accompaniment of his own violin. It's Hamilton's way of thinking musically, but also of planning out larger work for more conventional ensembles. Culturefile's Áine Gallagher spoke to Andrew Hamilton about words, music, and being both Elton and Burney.
You gave me hope when all hope was gone.
It was sort of always there. I didn't really make a decision to do it. I just sort of somehow as a child ended up playing the violin, singing. It wasn't a conscious decision, it was just something that happened.
Gone, gone.
I'm Andrew Hamilton. I'm from Dublin originally, but I've lived around Europe a lot. I studied in England and then the Netherlands, and then I lived in Stuttgart and then Berlin, and now at the moment I live in Birmingham. I'm teaching here at the conservatoire here, so I've had quite a nomadic life, I suppose you could say. I don't tend to think of my work as classical or new music or anything like that. I just think of it as music. They're just songs, really. I would encourage people to think of them as songs. Some of them are 15-minute long songs. So it's exploring the song tradition in a different way to maybe people from pop and rock backgrounds. When I was living in Stuttgart, I was invited to be part of a Liederabend, an evening of song. So in German and French tradition, this idea of the song is it's a very normal, accepted idea. But of course, growing up in Ireland, we don't really have this Lieder tradition, except, I would say, in traditional music. Of course, that's Shannos, but the classical written down song is quite a foreign one. So I quite enjoy the foreignness of the song tradition. The written down song is an interesting tradition, but it's not a normal tradition in Ireland, a classical one, I suppose.
In beautiful May, when the buds burst open.
I have to be honest and say that some of the pieces, the text came after I wrote the actual music. So as I often play with this sort of game between, does text have intrinsic meaning on its own, or is it just something that you can add at the end and then people will feel it has meaning? So for instance, the track May, it's a short song.
When the birds are singing.
The melody came separately to the actual text, but then often you can find that text adds another layer that you didn't find in the melody. So I'm excited by the idea that text doesn't always have to be tied to the music. They can sort of add new things to each other.
I'm thinking about the Elton John, Bernie Taupin relationship when you're saying that.
Oh yeah, obviously I was thinking of them. Yeah, so I think I like that idea that you sort of leave it up to other people to find their meaning from the text. It's not my job to tell you what it means, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think people have an idea about songwriting being this really magical experience, and the words and the melody are born together, but it's so often not the case.
Nearly all the tracks on the album, the text came after the actual writing of the music. Some of them are very personal texts, moments in time, emotions. And one of the tracks is just uses music by Handel and text by him. So I took a recording of myself as a boy singing the Handel piece, but with English words that someone had added, and then I recorded myself singing the original with the Italian that Handel says. That particular piece that's called I wanted to somehow use this recording of myself as a boy, and a solution I came up with was sing now as a man whose voice is broken. It's also a piece about how men relate to their boys' voices. It's the way, sort of starting an exploration of what it means to have a broken voice.
So you had made that recording when you were, how old were you when you made it?
I think I was around 11.
Okay, what kind of a recording device did you use?
My dad just recorded it on one of those old cassettes.
Wow.
So you can hear a lot in the background. The rest of the tracks I sing and play the violin at the same time, which I have to say is quite a stupid thing to do because it's when you've got your head right up against the violin, you're trying to tune yourself with this source that's right beside your head, so you have to work a lot on tuning yourself to this, so that's quite a challenge. That's the main challenge. It's quite fun but sometimes a bit ridiculous. I think what I've realised is that over the 14 years I've been doing it, doing these pieces by myself has really helped write the larger scale pieces, because when you don't have to worry about explaining things to other people, you can experiment more. So I learned a lot about how to write in general just by making these pieces, because it's more private process. You don't have to go to someone at the end and present them.
Andrew Hamilton there, and the reporter was Anya Gallagher, and Andrew's album Joy is on the Ergodos label. Now, journalist and environmentalist Paddy Woodworth has been helping us lately build a pandemic-proof bookshelf of nature writing. This time, Paddy has been rereading the work of perhaps the most celebrated of the current harvest of nature writers, Robert McFarlane, whose recent Underland struck deep with contemporary readers. But for Paddy, it's McFarlane's 2007 book, The Wild Places, that we might most usefully reach for now.
A sense of wonder lies at the heart of Robert McFarlane's relationship with the natural world. And wonder echoes like a bell through his exemplary writing about landscapes, their plants and creatures, and their people. Once wonder has been chased from our thinking about the land, we are lost, he writes, in the wild places. This 2007 book records his journeys to far-flung corners of Britain and Ireland and how they reshaped his own thinking about what we are talking about when we talk about wildness. McFarlane's accounts of the quirky particularities of his encounters with summits and salt marshes, moors and forests and holloways, these last are the ancient sunken roads of southern England, they're always engaging. And every adventure is artfully interwoven with erudite but accessible mini-essays on questions provoked by these landscapes. McFarlane's reflections roam across many aspects of literary, natural and social history, from woodland ecology to wave motion, from the night walks of Samuel Taylor Coleridge to the horrors of the Irish famine. But each path of inquiry always leads McFarlane back to the central importance of exercising our sense of wonder. Speaking of the work of Rafe Bagnold, a rather obscure expert on the dynamics of sand dunes, McFarlane writes, information for Bagnold was not a way to summarize and close down the landscape, but instead a way to make it more astonishing. Science, for him, refined the world into a greater marvelousness. McFarlane's own work could hardly be better described. There are lots of places one wants to go in talking about Robert McFarlane. There is his playful and luminous collaboration with the illustrator Jackie Morris in The Lost Words. This is the spellbook whose success has been the best revenge against the Oxford English Dictionary's shameful decision to cull words like acorn, buttercup, and kingfisher from its children's version. Then there is his monumental recent book, Underland, where this celebrator of wide open spaces and lofty heights plunges us on the most unlikely but exhilarating odyssey beneath the surfaces of our planet. And there is much, much more. But I think it's particularly interesting to go back to the wild places at this moment in our culture, when concepts like wilding and rewilding have become so current in environmental conversations. When Jack London wrote about The Call of the Wild, he was pointing us towards remote places where people, or at least people like us, appear to have made little or no impact on the land, and certainly have no contemporary presence. And this is very much the kind of wildness that McFarlane is seeking out at the beginning of his journeys in the wild places. He sees himself following the footprints of early British and Irish monks who sought out hyper-isolated spots for uninterrupted contemplation of eternity, but where, their own rich nature literature suggests, the blackbird's song often spoke more clearly to them than their church's liturgy. McFarlane is a formidable, though modest, outdoorsman. He repeatedly strives into landscapes that would daunt most of us at the outset. Halfway through the book, however, his pursuit of the harshest, least inhabited places hits a wall. Spending the night on the grim summit of the inappropriately named Ben Hope in the far north of Scotland, he realizes that he felt no companionship with the land, no epiphany of relation. This place refused any imputation of meaning. It is a fascinating pleasure to follow him for the rest of the book as he discovers new forms of wildness, from the miniature jungle in a fertile grike in the Burren to a scrap of wildwood in, of all places, Essex. He learns that wildness is, as he puts it, a process, something continually at work in the world, something luminous, tumultuous, green, joyous. And he continues, this was wildness quite different from the sterile asperities of Ben Hope, and perhaps, I thought, for the first time, more powerful, too. He learns from his friend and mentor, wildwood and waterlog author Roger Deakin, that wildness is everywhere. He recalls with barely restrained heartbreak how Deakin's untimely death ended their happy wanderings together. But Deakin's last lesson to him, he suggests, was to become an explorer of the undiscovered country of the nearby. While McFarlane clearly remains drawn to distant and challenging places, he has clearly learned to cherish the wildness in, as Aldo Leopold would put it, his own backyard. And it's no surprise to find that he has also been gently assisted by his little daughter Lily, who still knows full well that there is wonder in every blade of grass.
Paddy Woodworth there on Robert McFarlane's 2007 book, The Wild Places. Why not order it in an independent bookshop, most of which are open again since Monday. And if you'd like to hear other stops on the Naturalist bookshelf, check out Culturefile on Spotify. Casa Overall there with Please Don't Kill Me from his new album, I Think I'm Good. And finally on the Culturefile Weekly, we are with our no longer locked down in Kilkenny correspondent, comedian and writer Maurice Gohan. And this time Maurice is contemplating the true meaning of phase two of loss and grief. Yes, it's not all lols, even now.
Let's talk about mental health and coronavirus. Remember when we all just called it that? And then some people had to try and one-up the rest of us and call it COVID-19. Okay, scientist. They're the same people who bring up Ulysses at parties. It's just academic masturbation. Look at me. I'm smart. And now the cool kids are one-upping the COVID-19ers and calling it the Rona. The Rona, like it's some festival in the Bahamas that Netflix will do a documentary on. The COVID-19 Rona Express came into our lives a couple months ago and it just destroyed life as we knew it. And it's okay to not be okay. We're living in a pandemic. But the opposite is true too. It's okay to be okay. And that isn't trivializing anything. People have lost their livelihoods. People have lost their lives. We've all lost an intrinsic part of humanity, our ability to connect with other people and our freedom. And a lot of us are doing okay despite it. It's okay to be okay. I'm in lockdown at my boyfriend's family farm. Some days I wake up in terrible form. Not another roast dinner with all the trimmings, I say. I'm not in the mood for homemade rhubarb tart with ice cream. But most days, I love my roast leg of lamb and my scalloped potatoes and stuffed pork and ratatouille. Is that brave of me to say? Not my place to decide, but probably. I'm not saying everything is gravy, although my boyfriend's mother makes top-notch gravy. I still get bored. Every time my boyfriend bends down to pick up a fallen fork or tie his shoelace, I scream in excitement. You're proposing! Planning a wedding would just give me something to do. I still miss things. I miss going to get coffees every day. Maxwell House do their best, but instant coffee tastes like giving up dreams. I miss doing stand-up comedy, getting on stage every night and having people love me or hate me. A lot of times they hate me. One night after a show, I heard an audience member say on her way out, "That girl was so awful. She was terrible." And I was the girl. How I wish to be that terrible girl once more. But in general, despite my missing, I've been okay. As someone who struggles with their mental health, who has had long bouts of depression, periods of my life I didn't think I'd get to live through, me being okay has surprised me. 8 months ago, life was normal and good, and I was struggling. I would have thought something like this would have sent me down a spiral. and it hasn't. It feels weird to admit it until I read how many other people are also doing okay. Look, mental health is a tricky terrain. It pushes and pulls with a nuance that we often can't see until it's all over. My guess is we'll only truly feel the effects of this after the fact, when life goes back to normal. I have a theory that when something really bad happens, some big tragedy, we feel and act much better than we would have imagined. My father died when I was 23. He committed suicide. I always thought losing a parent would be the worst thing that could happen to me. I'm made from 50% of my mother and 50% of my father. How could I be without both of them here? Surely I would cease to exist. I'd fall apart. I'd stop being whole. And then the worst thing that could happen to me happened to me. And I was okay. I still woke up. I got dressed. I ate. I had an appetite. Everyone would remind me to eat, and I did. Cheesecakes and garlic potatoes and lasagna. Pasta bakes and scones and quiche. At one point during my dad's wake, my mother had to pull me aside. "Have some respect, Maurice," she said. "People in grief aren't supposed to be this hungry." But I was. This massive part of me was gone, but the world kept turning, and so did I. Everything felt fine. And then 2 years after he died, I walked along the canal and saw a man who looked so much like him, I went to shout out, "Dad!" And then I remembered. And the remembering crashed through my body. And that remembering hurt so much more than when he died. That's when I realized grief isn't linear. It ebbs and flows, and sometimes hits you when you least expect it. What we're experiencing now is a collective loss of how life used to be. And we will have to grieve that loss eventually. There's no clear path for this. All we can do is try. It's okay to be struggling right now, for whatever reason, big or small. Maybe a loved one has died, or maybe you miss going to the gym. It's all valid. It's also okay to be on your 95th loaf of sourdough bread and thriving. It's also okay to get through the other side and then start to crumble. The next year is going to be a crazy and hard time for almost all of us. Except people who bought stocks of Deliveroo and Zoom. They're probably living the dream right now. But for the rest of us, as we start to come out of this, I hope we remember to be kind to ourselves and speak out when we feel terrible. And God damn it, propose to me already. That last one is directed to just my boyfriend, but I'll accept unsolicited offers too.
Maurice Gohan there, bringing to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more Immodest Proposals next Friday at 7 on RTE Lyric FM, or if you're a podcast person, whenever you check your feed. Till then, bye now.